All right, it is 6:35. We, I believe, have quorum, so we're going to get this started. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Esri?
Here.
Michaels?
Present.
Rodriguez? Sexton? Store?
Present.
Straub?
Yes.
Locke?
Yes. All right, moving on. Can I get a motion for approval of the agenda? Motion by Straub, second by Michaels. Any discussion? All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Moving on. Can we have a motion for approval of the minutes from the August 7th meeting? All right. Esri, and second by Store. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Moving on, do we have any public participation? No, we will continue. We are rolling. Communications from the board. Oh, no carbon sequestration today. No, we'll talk after. I'll give you an hour of my time. Okay. All right, moving along. We have new business. See You at Home, revised request for funding. Could See You at Home please come forward and turn on the microphone when the red light. Okay. While they're getting settled, I'll just bring everybody up to speed if they may not know, because, we approved a large chunk of funding. In the interim, other funding came through for acquisition of the building. So we had funded $300,000 for acquisition and $280,000 for renovation. And now instead we have a request for something different, and thank you for coming.
Okay. Red means go instead of stop this time. Okay. Yeah, thank you for having us come back. We really do appreciate this opportunity to give you an update and then also to revise our request. So some of this is just refresher, and I'll move through it rather quickly, but obviously please feel free to ask us any questions that you might have. So we currently have two, what we call mid-barrier phase 1 through 3 homes. One of those homes is for people who identify as male, and one for people who identify as female. And that allows us to serve 16 individuals, again, in the mid-barrier phase 1 through 3 portion of our program. So what we are looking to do is expand that essentially by 10 beds. So that's that part of the request hasn't changed at all, just kind of refreshing where we are currently at. So in addition to the residential space that it would give us, again, as we mentioned last time, this would also give us an opportunity to have more direct contact with case management. And so we would have case management along with our administrative staff basically housed in the same location as our 26 residents. So I won't go over maybe that slide. So last time we were here, we did not know if the Housing Authority was going to be able to provide the full purchase price for the Matta Street property. And so we did put into our request the possibility that the funds that you provided to us would need to go for purchase. Part of that was that the Housing Authority was in conversation with HUD at that time, did not have an answer back essentially from HUD to confirm anything. The thought with Housing Authority at that time was if they weren't able to get the full purchase price by the time we needed to close or have that information back, we would move forward with what we knew we had secured from them, and then they would potentially go back and ask for additional funds for renovation. So now that they are coming in with the full purchase price, there will not be an opportunity for us to go back and ask for additional renovation funds, which makes a lot of sense to me. So we're very excited that they want to partner with us in such a significant way. Obviously, purchasing that building and coming alongside us with that partnership is very significant for us. In addition to the capital funds that they are providing, they are also providing a subsidy for our clients, and we're also working to get support-based vouchers for our clients so that once they move out of our program, they know that they can move quickly into their own place and into the voucher system in a way that allows them to not have to be in the long line and list of people waiting for vouchers. So again, just wanted to highlight that partnership. So kind of went through that. So the revised ask is that we are able to secure the entire $580,000 for renovations to the building. Again, as I just mentioned, we're not going to go back to Housing Authority to help offset some of those costs since they're coming in with a full purchase price. We did get an initial cost analysis of renovating the property at $2.5 million. We're working with a local developer and contractor who's got that price down pretty significantly, and we're continuing to work with him to determine what other pieces of that list and price points would be negotiable, what we could potentially get with in-kind donations, and he's willing to work with us through that process. So one of the reasons that we're really asking for you to consider the full $580,000 for renovations is because we firmly believe that the environment that our clients are in matters for their outcomes. So we want to design the space we are creating for optimal outcomes for our clients. When we moved out of the congregate setting, it was really important to us that we had the right environment for people to move forward. And so we actually right now are again in the 7 homes in the community, and that was very intentional. We knew that we needed to expand our program. We knew because of the amount of calls that we receive from people looking for shelter. We knew because United Way continues to tell us that most of the calls they receive to 211 are for housing and shelter. We know because we talk to Drug Court and other community organizations, other government entities that tell us there is a huge need for housing. So we were looking for a way to increase our capacity while still retaining the core integrity of our program, which means that we are not providing services in an institutionalized space, and we are not providing services in a congregate space. So we are designing the building that we're in to meet those criteria. Honestly, if we thought that we could acquire more homes within the community and keep those adequately staffed, we would have gone that direction. But it just isn't possible. It's not possible to find a house to allow 26 people to live in that space. And it's not possible for us to staff with the staff we have and the resources we have additional space that allows for that kind of capacity to be built out. So we did choose a building that had infrastructure, plumbing being the most important part of that infrastructure. So it has a lot of plumbing, but essentially the building is a shell. We can do anything we need to inside that building and design it any way we need to for optimal outcomes. One of those outcomes is safety. We want, first of all, really for us, our clients to be safe in that space. They need to know that their safety and their security is a high priority for us. Many of our clients have faced a lot of trauma. They have been in spaces where they have not felt safe very consistently. So they need to know that we are designing this building for their safety. We also want the community to know that we're designing it for safety. So it's important to us that this space is safe, but we're also designing it for people's well-being. We want, when people walk in to the residential portion of this building, for it to feel like they are walking into their homes. We want them to walk into that space, and we want a shift, actually, in the way their brains are processing the area around them. We want them to move out of survival, and the environment around them is incredibly important for them to be able to do that. Is there anything you would want to add?
So we've seen some of the things that Melissa referred to when we've moved out of the congregate setting at 70 East and into home environments. We've already seen some of these changes happen. We've had, as a result, we've had far fewer incidents with where we've needed to de-escalate clients. We've had far fewer relapses, far fewer, obviously far fewer police calls and that type of thing. Just a whole lot less behavioral issues. And so we, just from experience, we know that the environment that our clients are in makes a big difference. The other thing that I would add is we've been working on developing an intake matrix that aligns with the goals of the opioid task force, where we're giving clients who have an opioid use disorder and also IV users some priority so that we can align with the goals of the task force. And also, quite honestly, they're among the most vulnerable homeless population in Champaign-Urbana. So that's we're addressing for vulnerability and also to align with the goals of the task force.
So again, we're looking at, as Cedar said, really making sure that we're aligning with our core mission as an organization as we move into this. We want to be able to fulfill the requirements of our funders as we move forward with this project. We want our environment to, again, ensure that people feel that they're able to have dignity, self-worth, that they're able to feel empowered in their environment. I like this quote, the physical environment, we see that as much a part of our program as we do our case plans and goals and the trained staff we have. The environment is not separate from our program. It is part of our program. And so I think, again, we all know this instinctively. We walk into a space and the way it looks, the way it feels, impacts what we think we can do in that space. And this is just a small example of this with the two pictures. If we walk again into an office and into a waiting room, there's one of these waiting rooms that clearly feels inviting. I feel like somebody is going to help me. They want me to be there. I'm already developing trust just by being in one environment versus the other. And so it's so important that we design this space in a way that our clients have optimal outcomes. So this is the design that our architect put together, and I keep using the word design. Again, we're not talking about HGTV. Nobody's trying to figure out where we're going to put the fancy chandelier. I don't want anybody to be confused by what we're talking about. We are talking about, though, an environment that does feel home-like. We are talking about an environment where, again, you're going from, an activated nervous system to a calm and healing space. And we want our clients to physically feel that difference. And so this is what's been proposed. You can see, again, it's not congregate. It's a non-congregate setting. There are shared living spaces, and that's very important. Where we position our staff is very important. We want our staff to be there, again, to make sure that goals are being met, to make sure that the environment is safe, but we also want them to be organically embedded in parts of the building so that, again, it doesn't necessarily feel like I'm operating outside of a home environment to be in this program. So all of these things, again, are very intentional. Did you want to add anything?
No.
Okay.
We probably have some questions.
Yeah.
Ms. Michaels?
Yeah. Real quick, as I looked at the documents that are in our packet tonight and I looked up here, I didn't see where the ask was and for how much and for what specifically, because at one point one of your slides I thought said something about reoccurring, and then the other said about making, part of the $1 million adjustments here. So I wasn't sure because I don't see that number here for the request.
So I think the request that we're making is really that you don't essentially make any change to the funds that you've already committed to our project. So we're asking for the full $580,000 that was committed to the project to remain the same.
And that would be for renovations, not for purchase?
Correct.
Ms. Reitz, would you like to come join us in Ms. Rodriguez's spot? Because I know that you have some questions as well. And while we're waiting for our state's attorney to join us, I just have a question about the design. Will levels 1 through 3 kind of be living amongst each other, or will they be their rooms be separated? Or
so, yeah, phase 1 through 3 will be living there together.
Okay.
The separation, I guess, will be, again, identifying female and identifying male. And that does go back also to the importance of security and safety. There is a large cost to making sure that we have safe and secure separate environments. We do have a lot of primarily female identifying, but could also be male, that have trauma, sometimes related to being with members of the opposite sex. And so it's very important for us to have those spaces secure. But we will have phases 1 through 3 together. And then if a person graduates from phase 3 of the program and isn't ready for community integration, phase 4 would be going into one of the houses in the community.
Okay, thank you. And then, Cedar, this is probably a question for you. Could you do kind of a deeper explanation of the intake matrix to include more opioid users? Since this is opioid funds, we're
right.
Kind of limited in how we can spend them, so we need to guarantee that it's going towards opioid-affected individuals.
Right. So so we broke our intake matrix up into four categories. One is level of vulnerability. The second one is level of motivation. The third one is referral sources. And the fourth one might be special circumstances that we may have to make some accommodations for to see if the person is appropriate for our program. That might be, for instance, somebody with a history of violence, criminal history of violence, and trying to determine if it's related to substance abuse or if it's just they're a violent person. And so those are some of the things. But in terms of the vulnerability piece of it, one was we were looking specifically for people with we were going to give assess 1 point for a person with an opioid use disorder, 1 point for a person who is an IV user, recognizing that people use IVs for other substances as well. But because of its IV use, there's a higher risk of things like HIV, hepatitis, and other diseases that could potentially cause that person some harm. And then we would be looking if a person has been homeless for more than a year, they would get a priority. If they're homeless because of escaping an abusive situation, that would be another one. And that's not just physical, but it could also be emotional or financial as well, too. If they are a member of a marginalized demographic, we would assess a point for them as well, too. And if their mental health condition was the primary driver for them being homeless. Those were on the vulnerability side. And on the motivation side, just basically things like their willingness to participate in our program. We would, of course, give them informed consent to what our program is all about. And then whether they were willing to go to IOP, which is outpatient substance abuse treatment. One of the things that we're really excited about is the close proximity to Carl, which offers not only IOP, but medically assisted therapy. Their willingness to do medically assisted therapy and or medically assisted treatment. And that would be either for alcohol or opioid use disorders. And also whether they were willing to engage in mental health services and basically take medications that were prescribed to them. Because that can sometimes be a motivation issue. So those are in terms of vulnerability and motivation, those are the things that we're looking for. And then we would also give drug court a priority, as well as Rosecrans and Promise Healthcare as well too.
So if somebody was a drug court participant or going through treatment at Rosecrans or somewhere like that, they could also be getting priority. So not just like
yes.
the 1 point for being an opioid user, but
right.
an
yeah.
actual priority.
Absolutely. So so it's a combination of things. Obviously looking for vulnerability, motivation, and also looking for where referral sources.
And then I'm going to get to you. I just have one more question. You've been before the Plan Commission in Champaign. Could you let the group here know how that went?
So we did get a yes vote from the Plan Commission, and it will go to City Council on November 19th for the final vote.
And as part of that, we answered a lot of public concerns about the project as well, too.
Okay, so that yes was approval of whatever variances or whatever wouldn't be necessary
yes.
to get you
yeah we
in
there
that
was approval
space.
Of the special use variance. So the area where we're looking is zoned for residential use, but it had a caveat in it that it required nursing staff to be on site, and because we wouldn't have a 24/7 nurse that would be on site, we had to get a special use permit to use the building.
And so that goes before Champaign City Council on November 19th?
Yeah, November 19th.
Ms. Reitz, do you have?
I have a lot of thoughts, but I'm going to focus.
Could you get the mic? Sorry.
I have a lot of thoughts and concerns, frankly, but I'm going to focus my thoughts and concerns on what we are here for today. So you all have decided that you are the task force that is going to determine how to distribute the opioid settlement funds that we received, that Champaign County received, as a part of state and national litigation against big pharma companies, basically. And I, as your state's attorney, was part of the group of state's attorneys who moved forward with that process in order to receive those funds. Those funds are distributed to the different counties and cities. And the state as a whole, under a settlement agreement that includes very specific parameters as to how this money is to be used. And it is very specifically to be used to address opioid addiction issues specifically. Not and, but starting with. So one of the approved uses of the funds is to support people in treatment and recovery, to provide access to housing for people with opioid use addictions and any co-occurring conditions, including supportive housing, recovery housing, et cetera, et cetera. So housing is an appropriate use, but it has to be focused on and for people with opioid use addictions. And what is being described here is a much bigger situation. And so as your lawyer, I'm telling you that we would have to know that the money that you are distributing from this fund is only going to this particular purpose. And that is my biggest concern, because you're talking about more than half a million dollars to renovate a building in order to provide housing for 26 people, up to 26 people, and office space. And we've heard nothing about how to limit that to the particular purpose required under the settlement agreement.
Dr. Storr?
Thank you. Is this because we often see some of these as co-occurring disorders, alcohol plus? I've heard stories when I was working in the jail that astounded me with the range and amount of alcohol and various types of things people put in their mouth, and somehow these folks managed to live and live to be incarcerated, and they look forward to going out and doing more. So when you say it's only for opioids, could this be for someone who uses opioids and abuses other forms of alcohol and drugs?
Yes, co-occurring disorders, but opioid first. So I think this is a very noble cause and a very, you know, big idea. But the question is whether this is the right source of funds, or whether there is a different part of this process that these funds would better be used in order to ensure that you are using these funds for their purpose. So, for example, if there was a request for these funds to be used to provide treatment to a certain set of people who are living in this facility, those people being those who suffer from opioid use disorders, that I think would make more sense. But we're talking there, the ask here is to renovate a building that's going to be used by not just people who suffer from opioid use disorders. So I mean, I'm happy to hear, but as the lawyer for the county, and that is our concern and has been our concern, is how do we ensure that this money is being used for the purpose that it was intended under the settlement agreement?
Aaron?
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Julie. I understand your concern. I guess my question, would you have the same concern if it was for the original ask? Okay.
I did have that concern.
Okay.
To give a little context, before this was brought before us the first time, there's a different attorney doing the civil division, and we had received advice of that attorney.
Okay.
But then fresh eyes lead to fresh ideas and fresh interpretations, and it went up the chain of command.
Okay.
Then. And our lawyer is the one advising us now.
That explains just kind of how. Okay. Okay, that answers my question fully with that explanation, Jen, and thank you, Julia. So I understand, like I say, better completes the picture for me. Thank you.
Ms. Michaels?
This is kind of in a roundabout way here. I mean, my brain is going all over the place trying to figure out how we help people with opioid addictions with this program because I think it is a good cause, but it doesn't specifically meet the actual outline that we have to follow. So I wonder, is there a, oh, my light's on, sorry. Is this something that you would use to fund a person that only dealt with your opioid users? Or if there's a training or something like that, would that fit these funds?
Could you turn your mic back? Sorry.
Sorry. I didn't realize that it went off. Yeah, I think it's, we're kind of in a hard place right now because a lot of our clients either do have primary or secondary opioid addiction. It's rare for one of our clients who is in our program that is on the recovery track, which again is most of our clients, that they have not abused opioids at some point, primarily prescription medications. So I think that is part of the makeup and the DNA of the people that we're serving. I don't want to obviously misrepresent and say that that is every person, but we are making a capital request, so I don't know how we would renovate part of a building or how that would work. That was my understanding when it was really kind of brought to our team to make a request for funds was that the request was for, again, us to expand our services so that we could serve more people, again, with opioid addiction and through, you know, drug court primarily at that time. So I think a little bit maybe of what you're talking about might be like an operational, maybe like fee for service where we could look client by client. But I don't know how we would do a capital ask in that way.
I'll just jump in and I'll tell you, you know, and this might be jumping to another agenda item. But frankly, very frankly, when you first had your first meeting and I appeared and I said, you need to come up with a process, and frankly, that it should not be you all, because Diane, just as you said, this is not your area of expertise. And every other county who has this fund, this money, either gave it to their mental health board or established a task force of experts and a process and a application process and all of that kind of thing. So all of these questions could be vetted and answered before they came to the board. And that did not happen here. And that is unfortunate and not fair to these nice people, frankly,
Ms. Schwab,
my opinion.
I work with the same population, and I sit on the mental health board. There is no organization in our town that only deals with folks affected by opioid use disorders. That infrastructure doesn't exist in our county. We have this money. I understand that it is mired in obligation. And it will sit in our bank account for a very long time if we have to wait for an organization to form for us to spend it. Because we are not in the business of providing services. Mental Health Board isn't in the business of providing services. So we need to give this money to somebody who is providing a service. There is not a service that exists in our county that I am aware of that only deals with folks affected by opioid addiction. That's my two cents. That's all I'm going to say.
So I think I can speak for all of us. I think we all very, very much want to give you the money. And we also very much have to listen to our lawyers. So conversation going around the board. Aaron?
Another question for Julia, if you have an answer. I don't know if you have. Have you looked into how other counties? I mean, not that that's your job, but have you looked into it as to have they actually, or I guess, how am I trying to say it? You've seen the other counties where they've actually spent the money already on specific. I guess that's my thing. You know, have you seen, or if you've even looked, you know, it's on specific.
Very few counties have spent a significant amount of their funds because they are in the process of figuring
that
out
answers,
how to spend
that's
them.
That's my basic question. Yeah. I didn't necessarily word it the best, but that answers what I was asking. Thank you.
Dr. Storr?
May I pose a question? Could you elaborate a little further on the I wonder if some of the folks who are coming to you for services have used opioids regularly, occasionally.
Majority of them, she said.
So I can currently in our meds program, we have, I'm doing a quick head count here. We have 12, I believe, in our meds program altogether from top to bottom in the program. Is that right? 11. We have 11. And more than half of them have a history, have had a diagnosis of opioid use disorder. We have two people in our Midbury men's program currently who are receiving medically assisted therapy. We have one man in our advanced shelter who's receiving medical assisted therapy, and plus we have two others with opioid use disorders. So I think of the 11, we have five that have had a history of opioid use disorder. And like you suggested earlier, and I've worked in treatment centers, and one of the things I know from doing intakes in treatment centers is a person may present with an alcohol use disorder or a methamphetamine use disorder, but they have also used most predominantly fentanyl currently. And so that is a reality. And sometimes working in treatment centers, those secondary disorders are not necessarily always identified. For instance, a person may have been arrested with 5 grams of methamphetamines, and so they may not present necessarily with an opioid use disorder that they actually have.
And because I like to make things more complicated for us, I would like to remind everybody from when we've had various stakeholders speak to us, be it drug court, be it probation, be it law enforcement. Housing is always one of the biggest needs for people, for the warm handoff from jail to the community. You know, Captain Vogus told us she dreams of this warm handoff, and this we had envisioned as a way of doing that warm handoff. If we're limited to it being exclusively for the use of our opioid dollars, obviously that worked, but I feel like when we had talked about it before, we had been told that it was substantially, so if we had a guarantee of opioid, so if we're limited to exclusive, it's a problem.
Okay, and let me just say that I am not saying that there isn't a way to make this work, but this is a settlement agreement that has, as a lawyer you know, legally binding parameters that could affect our ability to get the rest of this money. So as your lawyer, I'm going to advise you that we follow the parameters of the settlement agreement, which may require these nice people to be a lot more specific about how the population that they're going to serve using this money fits into the parameters of this settlement agreement.
What if we...
It's not enough to just say we think.
No, I'm saying in the level of specificity, let's the $580,000 that's being requested is approximately a third of what your renovation costs are estimated at this time, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay. All right.
Half.
Yeah.
Depends on
what. So if we could then have an agreement in writing where half of your participants are opioid affected, would that?
But then the question is, how do you enforce that?
Yeah.
Because what are we going to do?
Okay.
You know, ask them to give us the money back?
Fair enough.
How do we enforce that? I mean, there could be ways, but I'm just saying in this forum at this point.
Ms. Straub.
I'm asking a question because I honestly don't understand. How long does it matter?
That's a good question.
Yes,
it's
I
a
have
good question.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is that there is no on the table. There is a, we need specificity. It's been a long day. But what is the specific specificity that we need? Because, you know, we're going to need more information in order... We're going to need more information in order to make any kind of new ask, right? So how do we get that for CU at home and for anybody else who comes to the table? This would be the same information that we would need if we were bringing this to the Mental Health Board.
And keeping in mind, if we would follow the plan later on to hand this off to the Mental Health Board, they would still need the same specific. So what specifics are lacking in your viewpoint?
Well, I think I've thrown out my big concern here about the use of this money, and of at this point over half of the money that you have. No other county has used that much of their money. Most of them are in the process of requesting proposals and evaluating the proposals.
So I think
that is what the Mental Health Board does.
Ms. Courtright, did you have?
Well, I just have two things. I don't know if I'm going to say this right, Mike.
You want me to say it?
Yes, why don't you say it? And then I guess my other question or my other thought is, and I'm not exactly sure this is what you're saying or not, but kind of looking at the calculations of what we're asking for, is it possible, or what we maybe are thinking, to hold beds, right, for opioid use disorder? So, for example, if we have 26 beds, these beds are dedicated to this part of the renovation has been, you know, provided by, so these beds are dedicated to people who have the opioid use disorder, which again is a little bit of our thought of prioritization with our matrix, that we are screening for those things and appropriately assigning the points, you know, to be clear, the renovation money we're asking for, again, wouldn't go toward like our administrative offices or anything. We're talking solely residential. So I don't know, again, if that is something that we could consider. I would just say, and I'm kind of sort of looking a little bit at Jen here as I say this, but when other community organizations have people who are homeless who need housing and know we have beds and we can only use those for opioid use disorder, I will just say that there'll have to be an understanding around why those, how those beds are reserved and why they're reserved, because we would want to be accountable. If we make that agreement, we will abide by that agreement, but that means that those beds are not available for just anybody, and I think that I'm just thinking about other partners in the community, but that was my thought. And then I know, Mike, you had something.
Well, I certainly, I'm Mike Royce. I certainly understand the risk that is attempting to get managed here. And I'm wondering if you would recommend some kind of a third-party, examination and testimony about, you know, its use as a potential step you might take, not to goof up the works, but I understand. So I wanted to throw that out.
Well, I think that the point that I'm trying to make is that there are lots of questions that have to be answered before you can make a decision about how to use these funds that are limited by the settlement agreement. And I'm sorry that I was not involved in these discussions earlier. I will apologize for that, although. But I think that my advice as your lawyer is to slow this process so that all of these questions can be answered appropriately in the best interest of everyone. And can I just add also, this is really not the appropriate forum to be having these negotiations.
That was going to be my next point. So, Ms. Reitz, would it be, before we just say, yes, we'll talk about this later, or we're very sorry, no, do you envision that there would be a way, if there are 8 beds set aside for opioid use disorder, would there be a way where that is a permissible use of our funds, if it's in writing that that was what we would have? Do you envision that could possibly, if we ask all the right questions in a different forum, or should we tell these nice people we are very, very sorry? Well,
I think this
would be over the next negotiations over a month or so.
I'll just end by saying, as a lawyer, there's always a way if there's a will. But we have to make sure that we're doing this right so that we don't jeopardize the rest of the money.
So, Michelle?
Yeah. Can I propose that we... the committee give us until right after the new year, mm-hmm. and I will work very, very closely with Julia's office and with CU at Home and see, just explore if we can come up with any type of parameters that address the concerns and would allow us to make this kind of funding allocation. And if we can't by the beginning of the year, then I think that we're all pretty smart people, and I don't think it's doable, but I think a little bit of time might be something we could talk about.
Shell, that was exactly what I was going to suggest. Julia?
I'm going to suggest you wait till you discuss the administration of these funds before we go into some sort of a disbursement discussion. Michelle, I appreciate your passion here, but this is a lot of money, and there needs to be a process for it. There has to be, in my opinion. It's, you know, you're the county board, but no one else is doing it this way. No one.
Ms. Straub.
I'm okay with that. I think the money does a lot more work if it's spent than in our bank account.
All right, so I think at this time we're going to table it, and we will be in great discussions with you, in numerous discussions with you in the coming time. Thank you for coming tonight. If we didn't have these limitations, thank you. All right, moving on, we have Rosecrans' request for funding. Michelle, will you be able to speak to this one?
No, but Kate will.
Oh, okay, great. Kate will. Yes.
Can I jump the gun? And this is kind of in that same vein.
Yeah.
So I don't know if going through this is going to be, we're not going to be able to vote on anything. It's nice to hear. It's nice to know. But this also falls in the same line of not specifically
All right.
for opioids.
Okay. It is... the addiction medicine practitioner is to perform medically assisted treatment for opioid use. So, okay. So is there a motion to table this to a later meeting? Yes, Dr. Storr, motion to table. Any second? I hear no second. I feel like we can.
I don't mind hearing it. It just says oversee medical treatment of clients with substance abuse disorders. So it's not specific, and that's where I was coming from. You know, if we listen to it, that's not going to hurt us any.
All right. Kate, can you come on forward and give your presentation? You come on forward. It's easier if we're looking at you. I'm sorry.
Do I need to withdraw the motion to table?
There was never a second, so you may withdraw it if you'd like.
So we've been in discussions with Melissa Pappas at Rosecrans, and one of the big things that they are working to do right now is get a local physician to do their MAT, and that is for opioid users. And that's a big need that we have heard from Judge Dyer on the drug court team, as you know, as well as all throughout the county. So they have postings that are live. They seem to have a good pool of applicants, although I haven't heard anything beyond that. But they believe that if we could assist them with a bonus for this physician, that would make it a little bit easier to get someone local. And what they've asked for is $7,500 for that.
And there's no pressing need at this exact time because they don't have the applicant in hand at this point, correct?
Right. Okay. That's my understanding, yes.
Anyone have a pressing desire to to vote on this now, or should we just hold off until we have a specific request?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we'll hold off. Seems to be the way that we're going there. But probation department, Shannon Siders, come on forward with a very specific request. Hi, Shannon. We'd love to give some money to our in-house. I do mean this.
But I also have concerns about making sure we're doing it correctly. Like, I want to make sure we're using it the way it's supposed to be used and figuring out the appropriate way to do that. So there are, you know, 34 clients on drug court, but there are over 1,200 clients on regular probation. And some of those also have opioid use disorders. So occasionally we need to transport them to treatment, inpatient treatment in Springfield or some other place. So right now what's happening is a couple of probation officers will clear their calendars when we find out we have a bed available, and then we'll take them over to potentially Gateway or Our House in Charleston, someplace else, to just try to get them there when the bed becomes available.
So that's two probation officers for a full day, basically.
Yeah.
Shortened staff, correct?
Yeah. So it's taken, I don't feel comfortable just sending one officer with one client, so I feel like we have to send two, but that means somebody's got to see their clients, and that takes them from being able to do their own work. So where I would need some help trying to figure this out is I don't know the appropriate way to get them there. Like, I don't know if it's best for us to call a cab for them, so if I was asking for money to help pay for transportation costs so our staff weren't doing it and spending their own time, their work time, making the transports, I don't know what the best solution is to try to get them there. So I don't know if that's like a Uber gift card, but then what if they don't actually go? So I have the idea, but I don't exactly know feasibly how we enact the idea.
So the idea, just to kind of flesh it out, is we preserve staff time and we transport people to residential treatment when it's necessary. And
yes.
If they would no-show, that is a violation of probation, correct? So this is personal responsibility on the probationers.
Yeah.
Okay. How much? Oh, Aaron.
This may be kind of off the wall, and granted, the details would have to be worked out. But something that just occurred to me was the idea of voluntarily, like off-duty sheriff's deputies, and not maybe even. I don't know if they would be willing to. I mean, I don't know if they would or not, but they would have.
We would have to pay them.
Well, it's asking for the money, so that's just, you know, they would be kind of they'd be able to. I mean, to put it frankly, they'd be able to carry their weapon with them. I mean, just in case security issues, something should arrive. Again, that. Maybe somewhat off the wall, but it's just kind of top of my head. I mean, granted, voluntary. I mean, it's not something like, hey, you know, you're getting mandated to give up your off time to transport these people.
I mean, and I don't know what kind of mandates and, you know, what – I don't know how much other time they're already –
I know. Yeah. So, I mean, again, that's where it's off the wall.
Yeah. I mean, it's an idea.
That's just an idea. I mean, it's just throwing that maybe just kind of a little bit of a key idea out there. I mean, the small piece of the puzzle that maybe fit, maybe some of the time slots, I guess you could say, to transport these people.
And we're not talking about a lot of people either. I've looked at our numbers of clients testing positive for opioid use this year, and it's not a lot, luckily.
How many on average?
When I ran the numbers before I came in today, there were 32 positive opiate tests.
So is that this whole year?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. That's not very many.
And several of them were the same individual. I mean, there was one person who had five positive tests over the course of the year. So it's not a huge number of clients. So I would not be asking for a lot of money for this. But again, like I said, I don't know what the best way is and the best liability way to get them over there.
Ms. Straub?
Do other counties have similar processes where like two officers take them, or how does that usually work?
I don't know how other counties are doing that. I know some counties will take them in their own, a county vehicle, and that's what we have done before. We've also paid for bus tickets for clients. We've done that before. But again, you know, that's, you're risking, I buy the bus ticket and you don't get on the bus. But, you know, that's going to be a risk.
How much do the bus tickets generally cost?
I didn't look up bus tickets. I did look up taking a cab over to Springfield, and that was $100. About an Uber or a cab is about $100.
I'm sorry.
Ms. Straub, you can finish.
You also run the risk, though, of anybody leaving treatment at
Correct.
Any time, right?
Correct.
So
there's always going to be.
I don't personally feel one way or another about losing the money, because, you know, that's just a risk of anybody dealing with addiction, right? And I think that bus tickets wouldn't run more than $50, because I bought some bus tickets. So that's, I guess, my whole two cents.
Michelle?
If the person doesn't show up, though, are we in a hot spot with the settlement money if they don't end up going like they were supposed to and we spent the money on something and they didn't show up?
It was still for the treatment and, you know, the assistance of opioid use, yes, if they didn't show. Our lawyer is coming again. Thank you for joining us tonight. We do appreciate it.
So again, I think this is one of the things, this is a absolutely appropriate use. I think that court services could absolutely be able to monitor who was using these funds and make sure that it was somebody who falls under the parameters of the settlement agreement. The mechanics of it can be worked out. I do know, I think Kane County is using some of their money for this sort of thing, transportation to treatment. So I think that's absolutely appropriate, and the details can be hashed out. So,
Michelle, did you have?
I was just going to ask, so you don't have a security concern about the actual transport of the person if you're considering just a regular cab, correct? Okay. Because, I mean, I think the easiest thing would be to just get a contract with a medical taxi service, and then when you need it, you call them, and then you know that you've done door-to-door for the individual, and whether they stay in treatment or not is beyond your control, but you've got them there as efficiently as possible.
Mike?
Nope. So, yeah, I don't know the logistics of doing some sort of contract with a company like that.
How does anyone in the room on the task force feel about just setting aside a very small amount to start that then could be renewable if need be, maybe $1,000, $2,000 of our huge lump sum right now, but set some money aside for probation for a transportation fund so that we can then, okay, show of hands, yes, okay, $2,000 set aside for transportation? Okay. Diane?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. But the other thing is we need to have everything spelled out as to how and why, because I think kind of, you know, the accounting background in me says we have to have proof and we've got to have backup and we've right. got to have numbers, and you've got to be able to pull that out later if you're ever audited or mm-hmm. asked. So I think when you have your plan, then we will have the funds to help out with that.
So we'll direct admin to work together with you to kind of set up the system in place, and hopefully that can help keep your probation officers here where they're extremely overworked.
Yes.
And then if there's ever a specific request, hopefully we'll have somewhere to send you to make it.
And it won't be yeah, us. I mean, I specifically asked my staff today if they had other ideas because I knew I was coming here, and I have not been at any of these meetings thus far. So, I mean, I do have other thoughts and ideas that came from my staff, and even the discussion that we had with the mental health board study session last month, I think there were some ideas that were talked about there that might be appropriate for use for this.
We will talk in the future.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. We now know the reason that we need to talk about the administration of opioid settlement funds. So when we started having our meetings, we wanted to get a lay of the land and get educated on what the stakeholders said the priorities should be. And anyone in here can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like our preference was housing, treatment, specifically medication-assisted treatment, and education, I know is a big one for Ms. Michaels. So with those identified priorities, I would like to add helping probation as best we can, knowing what we know about the rest of them and knowing that we do still have some opioid-involved individuals not in drug court. I agree with Ms. Reitz. We're not the best place for this. So one of the options that we have is working with the Mental Health Board to administer these funds. And now I'm going to go to Michelle. How are we on the discussions for that? It's Kate again. Thank you, Kate.
So I have not had any discussions with the mental health board about this, but basically we see two options. One is that we hand it over to them entirely and then, you know, maybe meet on a regular basis to check in on them. The other option would be, you know, something like what Julia mentioned, an application process goes to you, and then you work with the mental health board at that point.
Thoughts from the task force on either of those? No. Dr. Storm.
I'm concerned that the mental health board is going to run into the same problem we're running into. I don't, fortunately, haven't had a lot of experience, personal or family. So all I know is kind of what I've heard from others about their drug use or alcohol, drug. And I know that there's some real diehard, devout alcoholics out there, but when it comes to some of the folks that I more frequently run into, they use a variety, and I'm wondering, are other counties struggling with this same sort of restriction, and or not just counties but other entities?
As Ms. Reitz had told us earlier tonight, many counties are vetting requests right now. The bulk of the money has not been spent anywhere. And remember, it goes on for, we get yearly-ish distributions for 15 years, but we do have a lump sum right now. Everybody's still vetting it.
But the fact that we're not seeing a lot spent leaves me wondering why. And I know that there's been some real heavy restrictions on opioids. I remember once, my decades ago, a doctor told me that he would never prescribe an opioid, because I had asked him, "Is this particular thing you're prescribing?" And he said he would never do that. So I think that there's a lot of restrictions, so I'm wondering how easy it is to get that stuff.
Ms. Michael.
I would think that there could be a subcommittee within the mental health board that included a couple of board members, and because we've gone through some of this and we hear some things, but they have contact with the people that use services quite often. However, I still like to at least have some oversee, if you will, from the board as a whole, and maybe a lot of the other people on the board will feel like they have an onus to it also, if there are a couple of board members on a special task force within the mental health board. But we'd have to ask them for that. I mean, they have a lot on their plate. However, this is an unusual, this is an anomaly that, you know, we've kind of been laid with. So maybe we could do something like that.
Ms. Reed?
Can I just give you a little information? Just yesterday, 2 days ago, Kroger settled. I mean, this is ongoing litigation. Kroger just settled, and Illinois is getting $40 million. You know, so this is ongoing litigation, ongoing settlements with a lot of different large companies. This is, and we've only really just started getting this money over the past couple of years. So we are not at all behind the eight ball on this. And many counties, did a quick Google search, and I've printed out some documents, you know, have partnered with their mental health boards to, and that's what the mental health board does. They have the ability to vet, you know, to request proposals, to require particular standards, and to, you know, vet those proposals. And you're part of the mental health board. So I have talked to Lynn Canfield. She wasn't able to be here tonight, but I just strongly urge you to make sure that we're using this money according to the settlement agreements and in the best interests of everybody for the purposes of this money that is still coming in.
And we thank you for your counsel. It's good for us to be kept on the lane. It's good for us to be kept on the lane. Well, it's a depressing night. What should we do? Should we... I'm just going to go through. I'm going to Stephanie Furtado this and go down the line. And Aaron, you're on the hot seat. Do you think we should mental health board or at least explore what it would be to hand control over to the mental health board?
No. Definitely don't have a problem looking into passing it, you could say, off to the mental health board. That said, I think kind of what Diane was saying, it would I kind of hate to see it entirely turned over without somewhat of the county, the full county board having a smidge, I'm just going to put it this way, a smidge of oversight as to, like, if they had a huge request just for whatever and it fit, but for some reason, you know, the majority of the county board for some reason says, or let's say they had two requests come in and it was going to use up what we had in the bank, but either one of them, the majority of in the bank or whatever, you couldn't do both, to where, you know, the county board can maybe say, well, this is the one that we would prioritize. So since they both fit, you know, the county board would say, put it towards A instead of B or B instead of A. I mean,
so explore handing over administration to the mental health board with a subcommittee created that includes county board members.
Well, I don't know.
I believe that's what Ms. Michaels.
Yeah, kind of a subcommittee, I guess. Or, yeah, I guess, as opposed to maybe the full board.
I think my thought of that was to get started. That's not to have it completely and entirely. Because I do think there are, and I'm not going to be here. So, you know, what happens, I'm looking forward to having a little on the northern end of the county there, to be honest with you. But I think that there are some people that are vested in the issue, and I don't want to discount that. And I also want to make sure that we keep tabs on this because it is reoccurring. It is reoccurring. And we also have a responsibility to check in on it. And sometimes we just go, okay, all right. But I think in the beginning, we all need an understanding of it. And that's not to say down the road, we say, okay, hey, you know what? This has been great. Everything's going smooth. We've got a better idea of what we should be doing with this and how we're going to do this or how we're going to maintain certain things that we've started by using this money that'll be coming in for many years. But that would be helpful. I just think they do have the expertise, but we can learn from that.
Ms. Straub, I really am Stephanie Furtadoing this.
Can't go wrong with foreshadowing. I mean, I trust Lynn and her staff implicitly. They're, you know, the upper echelon of professionalism. And there, you already have county board representation on the mental health board, which will not be me. But the rumor is that some county board members are coming back to the mental health board, so, you know, which will not be me. I will not be here. Do with that what you will.
Dr. Storr, what are your thoughts?
I've worked with the mental health board, been on the with the GROW program, and I've been to their meetings. And I sure hate to throw something like this on top of everything that that board does. What do you think? What do you think? Could they handle it?
I defer that whole line of decision making to Lynn and her staff.
I think a board that a special purpose board that uses the mental health board administration would be desirable. I don't know if anybody from the county board needs to be on it. We're not on the Zoning Board of Appeals, but, you know, for example. I would like to see some folks on that board who have some addiction expertise. And I'll let you go to the next.
Julia.
So I think from my research and discussions with my colleagues, it's done both ways. Some counties have given the entire responsibility over to their mental health boards. Others have created a small task force that included a variety of experts in the addiction field, court services, sheriff, state's attorney, public defender, county board members. By way of history, we have quarter-cent sales tax money that was initially sought to build the juvenile detention center, and as part of that, a certain amount was set aside to be used for delinquency prevention funds, and when that started, the county board was determining how to allocate that money, and it was $5,000 here and $10,000 there, and it was very political, frankly, and chaotic. And ultimately what ended up happening was gave it to the mental health board. And the mental health board, and Lynn was there at that time, created a process. Peter Tracy was in her role at that time, created a process where people put in applications for that money. And they had a group of people, you know, who were involved in juvenile justice assist them in vetting those programs, and ultimately, but then also then come back to the county board for approval of the decisions they were making. And then ultimately that ended up resulting in the Youth Assessment Center, which is where that money now goes. So that's history here, if that helps.
And we can see history teaching us a lesson if it's left just to us as a political body without the professional expertise in these areas. Michelle?
Yeah, just to piggyback off what our state's attorney is saying, we've talked with Lynn. The mental health board is fine to distribute the money, administer the money. I think the next step is we don't need to go back and talk with them. You all need to decide what your recommendation is going to be to the board as to what you want that structure to look like. Because the board needs to make the vote on allocating the money if that's what you want to do, right? Like, we need to turn the money over. So in terms of, like, keeping things moving, you know, the mental health board is aware. They're aware of these conversations. They're aware of our interest in them assisting. So we need a structure as to what it is you're asking for. Are you saying you want to tell them what entities and they just monitor the contracts? You want them to vet proposals and bring decisions to you? You want them to do all of it, vet the proposal, hand out the money, get a quarterly report? Like, there's an infinite number of ways we can put this together. So I think the next step is, what do you think as the task force and the board, because they also have to be in agreement with this, are going to be most concerned about, and how do we build an agreement around those concerns?
Ms. Michael.
I think there needs to be discussion with the Mental Health Board on this. We can't just today say, okay, here's the money. I won't do that. And not because they're not they're not good stewards of it. It's that we really need to hash this out as to what they can help with, and what we kind of also have gone through with some of the processes that we've done. So I do see that there needs to be a meeting with the Mental Health Board and maybe the people on this committee and say, look, this is what we've got. And then we take that to the county board and say, okay, we've already discussed this. We've had a face-to-face, and this is what we feel is going to be in the best interest for serving the community that we have.
So I agree. Logistically, what that would mean is we have two offgoing members leaving us after tonight. And so we'll have to wait until we have we name two new members with whoever is county board chair at the time, then everything. So it would be January before we could get any of that done. Ms. Straub.
I would suggest, and I don't know, I mean, you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, but as Julia points out, Lynn and her staff have historically got the expertise on this. So would it make the most sense for them to draft a proposal that then came to the full board for approval? Because that way we're not trying to invent the wheel with our lack of expertise in this matter, and then come back and get corrected by Lynn, who knows what she's doing. That's just my suggestion.
As a member of the Mental Health Board, do you feel like that's something that, in your professional judgment from your time on that board, is that something that they would do? Would they write a proposal for us? Perfect.
I don't want to volunteer Lynn to do anything, but does that make sense to you, Michelle?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I think her first question is going to be, what are your priorities for the money? What do you want to see? Like, what is the philosophy that the board has with this money?
And we've set priorities, right? We talked about housing. We talked about medically assisted treatment, and we've talked about court services, right?
And transportation. Education. Yeah.
And how much oversight are you going to want to have? How much are you going to want to be engaged? Do you want to turn it over and be done with it? Do you want to, I mean, that's why I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm trying to make it actually work. And I think that she can't write a proposal if she doesn't understand what your expectations are.
If I were voting on this, what I would want, I'm sorry, I just keep talking. If I were voting, what I would want to know is what she thought was a reasonable amount of oversight. Because we'll all get in there with 500 different opinions, and that can be messy.
Ultimately, I think most members of the board defer to Lynn in matters of mental health board in what would be most appropriate, what would be most efficient, what would be most effective. Because we want, you know, these funds are compensation for a harm upon our community. So we want to get them out there able to remedy, not just be propping up our general fund. I like the balance in our general fund, but they belong to the community. They're compensation for harm. Ms. Michaels.
Would it be fair to say that the chair and another member of this committee have a meeting with Ms. Canfield and then come out with the specifics and then bring them to the full board?
I'd be willing to do that. You're leaving as vice chair, so we'll just have to have any other member that's willing to come with me. You're leaving, yeah. Yeah. Dr. Storr and I will meet, or Mr. Esri, yeah, yeah. We'll figure it out. I and someone else will meet with Lynn. We don't want to violate open meeting.
True, true. In that, from that.
Yeah. So the task force recommendation is for the chair and at least one other member to meet with Mental Health Board and explore handing it off and what that would look like and what the agreement brought to the full board will be. Yes? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 yeses. All right. Date of next meeting. I am going to say a big fat TBD unless I hear something otherwise. I feel like we have a lot to hash out before then. I have no chair's report. And I'm calling this meeting adjourned at 8 p.m. Thank you, one and all.